May it please the Court, Dan Griffith on behalf of the appellants, Mary Fisher and Dart. With me today is Scott Shannon, also of my office. By this appeal, we are simply seeking this Court to apply the principles of sovereign immunity to an endorsement in such a way that interprets the endorsement according to the actual words used in the endorsement, as opposed to rewriting that endorsement in a fashion urged by plaintiff's counsel or appellee's counsel to expand the waiver of sovereign immunity far beyond what the words of the endorsement actually say. As the Court is aware, this is an underlying personal injury action against a state entity, Delaware Transit Corporation, or DART. Because the defendant was a state entity, it could only waive sovereign immunity through an act of the General Assembly, in this case, to Delaware Code Section 1329. And the fact that this is an action brought pursuant to Delaware Code Section 1329 is an important critical fact for purposes of analyzing the waiver of sovereign immunity. Ms. McNutt's counsel has agreed and the trial court found that this is, in fact, an action brought pursuant to Delaware Code Section 1329. And that fact is going to be important.
What is the precise legal issue, as you see it, as far as the sovereign immunity claim is concerned?
The precise legal issue, and the most precise legal issue, is whether or not endorsement number two waives sovereign immunity on behalf of DART beyond the $300,000 basic auto policy.
Well, I know that's the surface issue, but is there a deeper issue that we have to decide in order to answer that ultimate question?
Well, if there's a deeper issue, it means going beyond the actual language of the endorsement to understand the purpose of the endorsement.
So is your position is that endorsement number two is not ambiguous?
That's our position.
It's facially clear.
That is our position, Your Honor. And
the court held otherwise.
Yes, Your Honor.
And resorted to evidence outside the four corners of the endorsement.
Correct, Your Honor.
So is the critical issue whether the court correctly or incorrectly found ambiguity in endorsement number two?
Well, I think that's one of the important issues, and it's certainly perhaps the most important issue, is whether the trial court erred in its interpretation.
We would have to decide that.
That's correct. Okay. And I think that's the main overall issue, is whether the trial court erred in, number one, finding the language of the endorsement ambiguous, and then interpreting it after finding an ambiguity in such a way as to find the endorsement applicable to this case. And one of the many things we believe the trial court erred in finding the way it did was concluding that this endorsement was purchased in response to an amendment to Section 1329. Now, the critical amendment we're talking to Section 1329 was in 1999. And in the trial court's opinion, the trial court wrote that this endorsement, which became effective in July of 2001.
I'm sorry, tell me where you are in your argument. Are we on issue number one, whether the court erred in finding ambiguity, or are we on issue two, and that is in interpreting an ambiguous?
Issue number two, actually, Your Honor. And if I may go back to issue number one, I thought I was addressing the court's concern on issue number two. But on issue number one, on whether the court erred in finding an ambiguity, all we would ask, and I know that the court has been inundated with paper, as did the trial court, all we would ask is that the court interpret the language of the endorsement in comparison to the actual language and words used in Section 1329.
Well,
and conclude.
In that regard, help us understand what was really in the language, because clearly there's immunity, but it's equally clear you waive your immunity to the extent you buy insurance. So when you have an endorsement that says if you don't have immunity, the insurance kicks in, it becomes a little confusing since you waive the immunity by purchasing the insurance. But why doesn't that kind of scenario make it ambiguous?
Well, I think if we look at the actual purpose of the endorsement, and frankly, the endorsement tracks the history of this court's decisions in the Carter versus McLaughlin case, and ultimately in the Pauley versus Reinhold case, which we would submit rendered the endorsement null and void as of April of 2004. And the purpose of the endorsement was because, as of April of 2000, there was a decision, the viability of which was at issue, but there was a decision which suggested that DART did not have immunity for claims of gross negligence, and that for those types of claims, Section 1329 would not apply, that those claims would be analyzed under the Tort Claims Act if there was an allegation of gross negligence which was proven. So there was a decision on the record as of April of 2000 which suggested that DART could be sued outside of Section 1329 and did not enjoy immunity for that.
Well, but that goes back to my question about this particular endorsement. It would seem that it could have been drafted much more clearly. You're telling us what the endorsement was supposed to be doing, and yet none of that is found in the endorsement. In order to get to your construction of the endorsement, we somehow have to read into it all of these other cases, don't we?
I'm not sure the court does, Your Honor. The title of the endorsement itself is telling, because the title of the endorsement states it is for damages not subject to the immunity statute, Section 1322 Delaware Code, well, Section
13. Let me try my question a different way. We'll just make it a hypothetical. If you waive sovereign immunity by buying insurance, and then you buy a $5 million policy, you've waived sovereign immunity up to $5 million.
For those claims to which that insurance policy applies.
Right, exactly. So whatever the coverage was.
Right.
If we move away and we go back to this case by analogy, at one time you had to have at least $300,000. The law was changed. You can now have more than $300,000. In this case, they're contending you've got more than $300,000, so you've waived beyond the $300,000.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that to the extent the endorsement applies, the endorsement is a waiver of sovereign immunity to those claims to which it applies.
Could I ask a real simple question?
Yes, sir.
What are those claims to which that would apply under your analysis?
As of April of 2004, there are none. But between April of 2000, when the Carter decision was rendered, and April of 2004, when the final Pauley versus Reinhold decision was rendered, during that four-year window, there was a potential class of claims to which this endorsement applied. And I understand Your Honor's question was simple. I'm not sure my answer is simple.
What was the class of claims that existed during that time?
The specific class of claims that were brought in the Carter case, which is claims for gross negligence where a court might find that those claims are not being brought pursuant to Section 1329. To the contrary, those claims alleging gross negligence are brought pursuant to the Tort Claims Act. And therefore, the $300,000 limitation, which was in 1329 at the time, would not apply. So,
okay, let me interrupt then. If your theory is that this policy language was to cover a potential liability for a claim based upon gross negligence during a limited period of time when that might have been viable, why doesn't the rider say, or that this additional insurance is for a tort claim established where the claimant establishes gross negligence?
Well, I'm not sure it's just gross negligence. I think in the Carter versus McLaughlin decision, there was language used such as wanton and willful misconduct, gross negligence, and the overall thrust I would submit of the Carter versus McLaughlin language was that if a claim goes beyond negligence, which is gross negligence, wanton or willful, those types of allegations are outside Section 1329. So I think, frankly, I think the best way to have drafted this endorsement was to have addressed the state immunity statute, to say if there are claims brought outside of 1329. And it actually mentions if a court determines.
But you see, all claims are outside 1329 if you purchase insurance to cover it.
In other words, it's a bit circular because you're saying the coverage was for those claims that are not covered by 1329, and 1329 says coverage means that the claim is outside of 1329 if you purchase insurance. So you've got two ends of the same question. It depends how you look at it, doesn't it?
It may, Your Honor, but I think the shorter answer is that if there was a claim that was brought outside of Section 1329 against DART, this endorsement would apply. And I think for 4 years, there was real potential for this endorsement to apply. I mentioned in the beginning of my argument that this is a case brought pursuant to Section 1329.
But what you're failing to focus on, and I'm sure we must not be asking the questions clearly, is that distinction was eliminated. You know, it was very unusual for our court to invoke the doctrine of vacator in the Carter case, but once that was eliminated and this policy continued, we no longer have that distinction between willful, wanton, and gross negligence. So sovereign immunity is always available, but equally available is the ability to waive it by buying insurance.
Yes, sir.
No distinction between any type of claim, negligence, willful, wanton, and gross negligence. So those are the facts of our case.
I think the terms of the vacation of the Carter decision is telling, because I think what Your Honor is suggesting is that as of the Carter decision, there would not have been a distinction. But because the manner in which the Carter decision was vacated, and my understanding was that it was an agreement between the parties, which was
I remember it very well.
I understand. The viability of that decision still remained at issue as of the Pauley versus Reinhold argument. And my recollection is that this court actually mentioned in a footnote that one of the parties, I assume the plaintiff in that case, actually raised the viability of the Carter v. McLaughlin decision as late as 2003-2004, and it was left to this court to confirm once and for all that the Carter v. McLaughlin decision had no application. So there was still an issue as to the viability of the Carter decision, even after its rendering in April of 2000, at least for purposes of DART to protect itself against potential claims that would be brought out. Pauley versus Reinhold did confirm what the court is saying, which is that you do waive immunity by purchasing insurance. But I'm not sure that that was firm, at least in DART's mind, between April of 2000 and April of 2004, while the viability of the Carter decision was somewhat in question.
Counsel, let me approach this from a slightly different angle. The argument that you're making articulates a plausible interpretation of what the endorsement might mean, assuming that there's some ambiguity. That is to say, there may be two ways to read the endorsement. That's certainly one reasonable way, but that presupposes some kind of ambiguity, does it not?
I think any time we look beyond the plain language.
So you're not arguing that we would have to adopt that slant on the endorsement, where that interpretation is a matter of law.
I would not argue that, Your Honor.
All right. So doesn't it follow then that we're starting from the premise that there is ambiguity in endorsement number two?
To reach the colloquy that we just had, we would have to first come to the conclusion that there was an ambiguity. That's certainly not our position. Our position is that the analysis does not get to that point, because simply reading the language of the endorsement, the policy, and 1329, the language is plain enough to find that if it's a 1329 claim and the endorsement says it does not apply to 1329 claims, the analysis should end there. But if the court concludes, as the trial court did, that the language was ambiguous, then the issues we've been discussing, I think, come into play.
So if this is unambiguous, define for us a 1329 claim.
That's what a personal injury claim against DART arising out of its bus operations is a 1329 claim, which is what Ms. McNutt's counsel has agreed that this is a 1329 claim. Every claim now is essentially a 1329 claim if it's a personal injury claim against DART arising out of its bus operations. So this endorsement does not have any applicability anymore.
Does the record indicate how much the state is paying for this policy?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. I would add one point on the ambiguity issue.
Yeah, to the extent that we're talking about ambiguity, doesn't that information have some bearing on what the parties understood they were buying and providing?
It's an excellent point, Your Honor, because it's a point the trial court asked the parties to address post-trial. And I think if I can divine the trial court's intention in making that request, it was to determine why keep the endorsement if it was no longer viable. And for an endorsement which seems to change coverage from $300,000 to $11 million, it would certainly seem that it would cost a lot more money in premiums to have that. The party submitted, the person that purchased the insurance for DART submitted an affidavit to the trial court And we're in the unusual position where the insured himself, the person who purchased the contract, actually said it was not intended to provide $11 million worth of coverage for personal injury claims arising out of bus operations. And we argued about whether or not that type of extrinsic evidence was proper for the trial court, but the trial court did review that, and that affidavit was of record before the trial court. My last point, I see I'm running out of time, and I wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My last point is that even if the court does...
Well, you're using your rebuttal time now, but you can continue to do that.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. But even if the court does find that there is an ambiguity, one of the fundamental principles of sovereign immunity is that a waiver of sovereign immunity must be a clear expression of intent by the General Assembly. So that even if the court found, as the trial court did, that there's an ambiguity, almost by definition, the court cannot find that the endorsement represents a clear expression of the General Assembly's intent to waive sovereign immunity. These sovereign immunity issues were raised by us on a motion for judgment as a matter of law for which we seek reversal. We also have sought a new trial for evidentiary decisions made by the court for a jury nullification issue addressed by the court, which I will hopefully reserve time for on rebuttal.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Zappa for the plaintiff appellee, L.C. McKnight. Unless the Court directs otherwise, I will not be focusing my comments on the challenges made by DTC to the evidentiary rulings made by the trial judge either before or during the trial, or the issue that came up during the course of the jury deliberations. Those rulings were within the discretion of the court to exercise, and the McNutt's position on this appeal is that those rulings were neither arbitrary nor capricious and in no way violated any recognized rule of law so as to cause an injustice in the trial of this case. McNutt's arguments this afternoon will focus on the correctness of the trial court's determination that endorsement number 2 provides $11 million of liability insurance coverage to the McNutt tort claims upon which the jury entered its verdict against DTC. The issue before this court is, before the trial court below and before this court on appeal, is ultimately one of insurance contract interpretation. The issue of sovereign immunity waiver was resolved prior to the start of the trial, and appropriately so, based on Pauley versus Reinhold. The two-step analysis had been done by the trial judge in that 1329 is an express, clear waiver of sovereign immunity for claims against DTC and the claims specifically that McNutt had raised in the trial. And secondly, there was liability insurance funded to insure against the risk of liability to DTC based on those claims. The only question is whether or not the coverage is $11 million or $300,000. And that's a question, once you get to it, of insurance contract interpretation.
Well, I think your opponent's argument is something like this. The jury comes back with a verdict, and the judge says, but for the waiver, by purchasing insurance, there would be sovereign immunity. And therefore, in this case, there's $300,000 worth of coverage, as opposed to the judge saying, under the facts of this case, there's no sovereign immunity. It just doesn't apply. And then they would say sovereign immunity doesn't apply, but we do have insurance against this claim that's not protected by sovereign immunity. Why isn't that a logical interpretation of this endorsement?
Quite simply, there can be no liability on the part of DTC unless two things occur. There's a statute waiving it, which in this case, the only statute is 1329, and a liability policy to fund the liability of DTC. That liability policy was purchased pursuant to 1329.
So this brings us to your argument that what you just said was clear after Pauley, and to the extent this insurance continued after the Pauley decision, it was a waiver at the higher limit.
Yes. And, in fact, we would take the position that the Carter versus McLaughlin scenario isn't really one in which endorsement number two, by its language in relationship to the policy itself, fully covers. Carter versus McLaughlin, one could argue from the decision before it was vacated 4 months after it was entered.
But you see, that's the Carter's out of the equation. That's the whole purpose of invoking the doctrine of vacator. It's like it never happened.
Correct.
It never existed.
That is correct.
So you, like your learned friend on the other side, also argue that there's no ambiguity. But your position is that the lack of ambiguity goes your way and not the other way. Is that
partially
right?
Correct, in the sense that after the court considered the synopsis to the 1999 amendment and understood the purpose of the amendment relative to the acquisition of the insurance, the only reasonable interpretation that could be given to the language at that point in time would be that the not subject to language meant not subject to the monetary cap that was imposed by the statute itself, which only applies to rail operations. So,
well, this goes back to Turnbull and Fink, when at one time there was a cap on the waiver altogether. And
correct.
I think what we see in this statute is a change in philosophy, whereas you have to have a minimum amount, and then you can waive to a higher amount. Isn't that what the General Assembly has done?
Well, it did that in 1977 with the initial amendment to the statute, which created a minimum for all transit operations of DTC. In 1999, the amendment, which is applicable to this case, it went back to the way the law was prior to 1997 when Turnbull versus Fink was decided, but only as to rail operations, and that's because there's contracts with SEPTA, and they provide insurance primarily when people are on the trains or getting on and off. So after 1999, the legislative intent clearly espoused in the synopsis was that the public was to be protected by increasing the amount of coverage from the minimum of $300,000. And that's why endorsement number two sequentially fits really quite well with the view that the trial court adopted in McNutt on appeal believes the court should affirm, and that is that it was purchased to implement the purpose of the 1999 amendment.
I'm starting to become confused here. If the idea here is that there's $11 million in coverage under this policy, right?
Correct.
If that's what it is, why doesn't the policy just say for personal injuries involving our vehicles, there's $11 million in coverage, period?
Justice Berger, all due respect, it does say that. If you read the endorsement number two, it uses words like the coverage applies to covered claims. Well, covered claims under the policy is a reference back to the auto liability protection policy.
No, so, what I'm getting at is why have the division, why have the $300,000 and then extra coverage as opposed to just saying the coverage is $11 million.
I apologize. It's my misunderstanding your question. It's my end, not your end. They need the $300,000 in coverage because there's still a segment or subset of claims that the basic policy would cover, and they are claims arising out of vehicular collisions involving DTC employees who are involved in the rail operation under it. Remember, the statute as it exists currently and at the time this policy was purchased allows for the purchase of insurance up to $300,000 of coverage. And it, in other words, that authority has to relate to some potential liability on the part of DTC for its rail operations. Now, they subcontract out much of what they do for rail, but not everything.
Well, the other side in the reply brief argued that there are no rail operations, so that under your interpretation of the $300,000 cap provision, basically, premiums, they're insuring for nothing, that is, for non-existent operations. On the other hand, if one accepts their position, then they're paying premiums for up to $11 million of coverage for nothing also, that is, for a set of claims that won't exist and can't exist. So under the position that it appears that this court is in is that if it adopts one position or the other, there's a null set someplace that we're going to have to buy into.
Well, there's the position the court can take that, indeed, the language of the endorsement not subject to means not subject to the monetary cap of the statute, which means that it would only the $11 million policy applies to non-rail operations. And that the policy,
and the $300,000 of the coverage applies to rail operations, which happen not to exist.
If you accept the premise, Your Honor, that the auto liability protection policy doesn't cover DTC employees involved in rail operation business but involved in vehicular accidents, that would bring into play the terms of the auto liability protection provisions. For example, it covers all of the DTC administrators. If an administrator jumps in a car, which is covered under the endorsement, it doesn't have to be a scheduled auto. It covers any auto. If you're an employee or an administrator going to a meeting to talk about deceptive contracts and you happen to run over Elsie McNutt on the way and she loses two legs, well, under that scenario, Your Honor, there would be $300,000 of coverage available under the auto liability protection policy. It's only where the monetary cap does not apply, which only applies to the rail operations, that endorsement number two takes effect. And that's consistent with the synopsis of the 1999 amendment.
That requires, does it not, a premise that there's ambiguity in endorsement number two? The same question I've asked opposing counsel.
But all candor to the court, at this point, I believe there is ambiguity, and the court found there was ambiguity, and it would be hard for me to argue there's no ambiguity in that endorsement because the words not subject to the immunity statute, what does it really mean? Not subject to, that is not within the scope of, or I claim that it never had its origins within, which is what the DTC is asking the court foist those interpretations on. Or does it mean, like the McNutt says, not subject to the statutory cap that applies only to rail operations? And that's where the ambiguity is. And I think it's fairer for the trial judge to then find that the endorsement is ambiguous and then bring into play the rules of contra preferendum, which, by the way, the court did not knowingly and willingly apply, but applied anyway to come to the same conclusion.
Well, even that's a default rule of interpretation. But putting that for the moment to one side, your burden, is it not, would be to persuade the court that your side's interpretation of this ambiguous endorsement is more reasonable than the other side's.
That is correct.
Would you make that argument?
Surely. Ours is more reasonable. In fact, we take the position it's the only reasonable conclusion based on a number of factors. The legislative intent of the 1999 amendment in relationship to the acquisition of the coverage. Secondly, the language of the endorsement itself speaks in terms of its broadening coverage. It speaks in terms of it applies to covered claims. If you take their position, it can't be covered under the auto liability protection policy itself. That can't be the case because the endorsement itself says it must be for covered claims. The third reason we would advance is that their explanation for what it covers doesn't make any sense because even under the Carter versus McLaughlin scenario, it applied to both ministerial and discretionary acts of state employees which were done with gross or wanton negligence. The endorsement, because it makes reference to the auto liability protection policy, doesn't even cover a significant subset of those acts. It only covers ministerial acts of neglect. Discretionary acts of negligence aren't covered under the auto liability protection policy. We've got to keep in mind that the endorsement number two is a specific endorsement applicable to the auto liability protection policy. So their argument would not hold water if you were to accept that the only reason that that policy endorsement was purchased was to cover the potential liability under a vacated null and void decision of this court. So we think that the policy itself, the language of it, interweaves pretty clearly with the auto liability protection policy. We think that the rail is covered under that, rail operations, and that's why there's a $300,000 policy, because that's all that the legislature determined would be the extent of the waiver of sovereign immunity.
And that's you get to that conclusion by reading into the analysis, the synopsis that makes specific reference to rail operations?
Oh, not only that, but that's part of it. If you just read the auto liability protection policy, it doesn't even mention DART. It mentions the insured, DTC. DTC is, in fact, a creature of statute 1993. Used to be DART before, and then it became DTC with subdivisions. It included everything, the DAS, which was the Delaware Authority for Specialized Transit, and included the rail operations, everything. So DTC is the corporation now, which is the umbrella entity. It is the one that's insured. And this is interesting because if you look at the policy itself, it doesn't say it only applies to bus operations. It doesn't say it doesn't apply to rail operations, that is, vehicular collisions involving DTC employees engaged in that kind of work. And this is the telling circumstance. The general liability policy doesn't mention a distinction between rail and non-rail, but it has an exclusion bargained for between DTC and St. Paul, which excludes a subset of claimants. And those claimants are people with claims who are passengers while traveling on the train or getting on or off the train. If that exclusion was necessary to carve out what otherwise would have potentially been included within the GL policy, that's the general liability policy, we submit it's pretty persuasive and convincing argument and evidence that if such was the case with the auto liability policy, you'd see a similar exclusion.
What about the issue of the cost of the policy and how that might bear upon what it was supposed to cover?
That's an interesting argument. If I remember the Turnbull versus Fink case, argument might have been made that, well, they had this additional policy and they pay a premium for it. You know, why shouldn't it be available? The easy answer, Your Honor, is this, that it makes no sense. It's hard to believe that the Delaware General Assembly...
No, again, I'm not talking about the idea that money was spent to buy a policy that provides no coverage. What I'm asking is, what about the factual issue in terms of interpreting this language in the endorsement and coming to a conclusion based in part upon how much it cost to buy that policy? Because one would think that if you were buying $11 million of coverage for basically any accident that took place on the highways, or most any accident that took place on the highways, that would be pretty expensive coverage, whereas if you were buying coverage that arguably applied to some hypothetical situation that later was determined could never happen, you wouldn't pay very much for that coverage. So where are we and where should we be in terms of looking at the cost of the policy as some indication of what the coverage was that was purchased?
For a couple of reasons. One, I don't believe that analysis holds water if the issue is one of insurance contract interpretation. It won't matter if the insurance company undersold its insurance coverage. It's only a question of whether the endorsement, when looked at, is ambiguous and confusing. If you reach that point, and it appears that there's not much disagreement that it is, in fact, confusing and ambiguous, that the rules of contra pro forentum then pertain.
Well,
and it isn't real. I'm sorry.
Mr. Zappa, just to follow up on Justice Berger's question, it was the trial judge that made the point in his opinion that one of the problems with the other side's interpretation is that it would require concluding that the state was essentially throwing away insurance premium money for coverage of claims that would never arise. And, you know, the conclusion being that's not a sensible interpretation.
That's correct.
Implicit in that observation was that the premiums that were being paid for that $11 million of coverage were significant. And the question is simply a factual one. Is there anything in the record that shows what the cost of the $11 million coverage was?
There is nothing in the record. We only know what the total premium was based on review of the policy as a whole. At least we have some evidence of what the premium was charged for the various coverages that it refers to. I might mention, my time is running out, that I don't believe that ultimately that would be an issue that the court would get involved in on a factual basis, because the rules of contra pro forentum tend to establish a very clear rule that it isn't what the parties may have intended by what was written in that endorsement. It's what, objectively looking at it, people in their position would have thought the language of the endorsement meant.
Well, the response to that argument is that contra preferendum is a rule of construction that may be applied against the insurer. But here you're attempting to apply it against the insured. What's your response?
I'm glad Your Honor mentioned that, because even the trial judge, when he concluded using rules of contra preferentum, even though in a footnote he said, well, it really doesn't pertain here because it's not a question of the claimant against the it's not a question of insured against insurer. Because of the unique nature of the statute itself, the waiver of sovereign immunity really is a state decision to protect the public, if in fact constitutionally the state is immune, then a positive act is necessary to create some benefit to somebody. And that benefit from the statute is to the public itself. So when you take that factor into play, if you were to allow the state, really, the public becomes the entity with the right and the standing to challenge the coverage itself, not the state. You would not want to put the parties in a position where the state...
You're saying it's by analogy to contra preferentum, but not strictly contra preferentum. Is that your point?
That is correct. You'd have to carve out a public interest exception and just simply force the public itself in the position of the insured. I do notice that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. In one sense, the analysis is whether the endorsement represents a clear expression of intent to waive sovereign immunity up to $11 million. And Justice Berger raised a good point in the sense that if it was going to be a clear expression of intent to have $11 million worth of coverage for auto claims arising out of DART's bus operations, why not have an $11 million limit to the basic policy?
And I thought you told us earlier when you concluded your opening argument that this clear expression of intent refers to an act of the General Assembly as opposed to the purchase of, that is, to language contained in an insurance policy, which is not an act of the General Assembly.
I think the extent to which there is a waiver of sovereign immunity, the analysis, there needs to be a clear expression of intent to waive sovereign immunity by the state, in this case, by purchasing insurance.
So you're not limiting this clear expression of intent doctrine to statutory enactment. It's whatever the state does.
Correct, Your Honor. That the state being insured.
The state signs on to insurance coverage with language that's confusing, poorly drafted, then the state gets the benefit of that in the sense that any doubts have to be resolved in favor of immunity. Is that your point?
In that case, Your Honor, the state would not have expressed its clear intention to waive sovereign immunity. In this case, what we have is a basic policy which shows a $300,000 basic limit, which I would suggest shows the DART's or DTC's clear intention to waive sovereign immunity up to $300,000. And if it intended to waive sovereign immunity up to $11 million, there would have been an $11 million basic limit. There would have been no reason for an endorsement. And my adversary's argument is that $300,000 basic auto policy has to apply to rail operations. And that's simply not what the basic auto policy says. In the basic auto policy, the claims to which it applies are defined, and it is autos, and there is a schedule of autos. And the conclusion that one must reach to find that my adversary's interpretation is correct must be that the basic auto policy, which is defined as an auto liability, uninsured and underinsured motorist policy, applies to rail operations.
Does that argument presuppose ambiguity or non-ambiguity?
We do not reach that argument until we conclude that there is an ambiguity. Because
I'm sorry, you're saying that it presupposes ambiguity?
It presupposes an ambiguity. Obviously, our primary argument is that
there's
no ambiguity, and the rest is in response to my adversary's arguments. The timing of the endorsement, which I mentioned in my opening statement, is also important, because if my adversary's argument is correct, that this was purchased in response to an amendment in 1999, the endorsement didn't go into effect until 2 years later. Now, if, as we argue, the endorsement was purchased in response to the Carter decision and the exposure which may have been created by the Carter decision, then it was the next effective policy period. And we would suggest that the interpretation that this was in response to Carter and the viability that a court could find after Carter that the state is exposed beyond 1329, that if a court did determine that, then that endorsement was important to protect DART's interests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement and adjourn.